Hello, everybody. Thank you for joining in this seminar on unlocking the growth potential regional economic corridors in Southeast Europe. I think we still have people coming in into the seminar, so I'll give it a second before I start with my introduction. Please stay tuned. Hello again. Thank you for joining this seminar. My name is Vasilis Manastiriotis. I'm a professor of contemporary Greek studies here at the London School of Economics and professor of political economy also at the LSE's European Institute. The event we are having today is on regional economic corridors in Southeast Europe, unlocking the growth potential in the region. The event is co-hosted by the Hellenic Observatory and the LSE Research Unit on Southeast Europe, LSE LISE. We are talking today about, of course, regional economic corridors, in a way, the unlocking the integration and growth potential of the region. We know that the region has, in some way, below potential levels of trade, investment, regional integration, problems of fragmentation, low quality infrastructure, and of course, on top of that, sit a number of geopolitical uncertainties. So we will debate today on the potential for the region to unblock, if you want, a bit of the situation and move on in, to exploit the potential benefits of deeper regional integration in energy, in the digital economy, in transportation, in trade, of course. It's all about investment, infrastructure, interconnectivity, integration. To take us through this discussion, we have an excellent panel of speakers with expertise both from the academia, but also the policy world. I will present our speakers first in the way that they will go on with the presentations, and then introduce our moderator for the event, Anthony Bartzokas, and I will pass the floor to him. So our first speaker is Will Bartlett. Professor Bartlett is a visiting senior fellow at LISE, the LSE Research on Southeast Europe here at LSE, and has acted previously as deputy director of the unit. His research has focused on socioeconomic development of the Western Balkans, and he has carried numerous research projects, including in the region, including evaluation of the economic and investment plan for the Western Balkans for the European Parliament, as well as projects for the European Commission, the European Training Foundation, the British Council, and others. Among his many works on the socioeconomic development of the region, he has authored a very influential book, Europe's Troubled Region: Economic Development, Institutional Reform, and Social Welfare in the Western Balkans. Our second speaker is Sue Barrett. She is the Director of Infrastructure in Europe, the Middle East, and Africa for the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development. As Director of Infrastructure, her team focuses on sustainable infrastructure investments in the areas of transport, in municipal, environmental sectors, and so forth. She's responsible for a big portfolio of infrastructure investments, something in the area, I think, of 10 billion euros, and finances around 45 deals annually, supporting the technical assistance funded by the EBRD shareholders and donors. The infrastructure team in the EBRD also mobilizes grant funding to support investments in best available technologies, climate adaptation, affordable and inclusive infrastructure. Sue has experience not only in the development banking world in the EBRD, but previously she was senior manager at PricewaterhouseCoopers, advising on privatization and regulation of utilities. And she's a former alumnus of the London School of Economics. Our first speaker will be Matteo Rivellini, excuse me, who is head of division for Western Balkans and Turkey in the European Investment Bank, specializing in infrastructure, impact investments, and development finance across Central Europe, Italy, Turkey, and the Western Balkans. He leads a team of 20 plus bankers, annually financing around 1.5 billion euro for sustainable investments in the region, Turkey and the Western Balkans, focusing on green transition, digital transformation, transport, small medium enterprises, and impact finance. Matteo has a vast experience in coordinating the European Investment Bank's involvement in EU-funded platforms and initiatives, including the Western Balkan Investment Framework, but also the Turkey Investment Platform, the Economic Resilience Initiative, and so forth. He is also authored a number of publications on sustainability and policy making, including his publication on Hope and Strength in the Western Balkans and Finance for Sustainability, a useful tool for policymakers. Last speaker in our panel, but not least in any respect, is Professor Slavo Radosevic, who's Professor of Industry and Innovation Studies at the School of Slavonic and East European Studies at the University College London. Professor Radosevic's work spans many decades of research, both in London at the UCL, but also previously in Sussex and in Croatia, as well as a role in government in former Yugoslavia, specializing in science, technology, and industrial change in Europe, especially, of course, in Central and Eastern Europe. Professor Radosevic publishes widely from a usually neo-Schumpeterian economics perspective, but always with much policy-relevant research. He has experience in consulting international bodies like the European Commission, the OECD, the World Bank, and others. Now, as I said, to take us through this discussion, we have our visiting professor in practice here at the Hellenic Observatory at the London School of Economics, and moderator for today, Professor Anthony Bartzokas, who is professorial fellow at the United Nations University in Maastricht, also associate professor at the University of Athens. Professor Bartzokas has extensive experience not only in academia but also in the policy world and real life exposure to investment decisions, innovation dynamics, and financial markets. He has been a previously board member of the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development, and he has in this role overseen a lot of the activities of the EBRD in the region. Before I pass the floor to Anthony, let me also make some housekeeping announcements. For those of you in the audience who are using the Twitter or X, the hashtag for today's event is hashtag LSE Greece, one word. The event is being recorded and will be made available as a podcast subject to no technical difficulties, of course. And after we complete the presentations and the discussion coordinated by Professor Bartzokas, our moderator, you will have the opportunity to ask your questions. We'll have a round of Q&A with the participants. You will have to use the Q&A button that you should be able to see at the bottom of your screen. And we will then collect the questions and address them to the panel. With these organizational notes, let me stop here and thank you all for joining and pass on the floor to Professor Bartzokas.
Thank you very much, Vasilis. And can I have my presentation uploaded and go directly to page 3, please? Okay, let me start with the motivation for this roundtable, for this panel. We all agree, and this is a consensus, that convergence in Western Balkans, but also the EU member states in Southeast Europe, is still below potential. The puzzle is what needs to be done. And the perspective we take in this conversation is that we need to go, say, beyond, say, aggregate trends and see how things work at the sectoral level, more close to real economy and, you know, practical side of life. That makes it, you know, very difficult and very challenging to put together. But today we're extremely pleased to have an excellent panel of people coming from academia, but also coming from real life, from the investment community. My role here is to set the background, a basic background, and then introduce our speakers, you know, one after the other. Let me start with my first slide. Page 3, please. Page 3. Page three. Thank you. What we have done here, we have the geography of the region, which is Balkans to the right, Western Balkans to the right, and EU member states in Southeastern Europe to the left. And we try to trace trends for the last 20 years. What you see is, indeed, we have gradual improvement, but still the convergence is really lagging behind. And there is increasing distance between Western Balkans and the EU member states, where I have to say, if you look at the dots, the progress is not very linear, at least for the last 15 years, you know, after the financial crisis. Next slide, please. What we have done here is we try to see what we can explain with, say, very aggregate trends. We take investment and we take savings. You see, you know, as we move to the horizontal axis, we see improvement in savings, but when it comes to investment levels, the speed and the momentum of investment for catching up is not there. So we need to go beyond that and see what is really happening in the region. Next slide, please. Here we take the benefit of the work that systematically is EBRD is doing on what they call transition qualities. And we try to see to what extent a qualitative approach can be more useful in understanding what are the bottlenecks. What we see here is that indeed there are important bottlenecks in governance, and there's also an interesting disconnect between investment in integration and the competitive positioning of the region in the world. Next slide, please. This approach of a more granular qualitative approach on what is happening in the region is confirmed here, where we see progress on transition qualities and GDP after the crisis. You see that there is a strong correlation of, you know, who does well on transition qualities and improves its GDP level. Next slide, please. We decided to focus more on three transition core, the three growth drivers. And the first is information technologies, the second is energy, and the third is transportation. What you see here, just to get a flavor of how important these trends are, you see at the horizontal axis, infrastructure development, and the vertical axis, to what extent this is being leveraged by the private sector. You see that the gap is really very important. You know, infrastructure is being developed, but the catching up of using it is still below potential. Next slide, please. We take it one step further and say, if this is happening, then to what extent you have value-added services being traded across the region and across the world? You see here that a very important problem is trade restrictiveness in the region for this kind of digital services. Next slide. Then to give you a flavor of what happens in energy markets, you see how important fragmentation is, both in the case of Southeastern European EU member states, but also in Western Balkans. The same trend applies to transportation. Next slide, please. There you see that there is a convergence between Western Balkans and Southeastern Europe. So the challenge here is to what extent transportation infrastructure is being linked with facilitation of trade in the region. Next slide, please. This is an important question, because if what we are saying so far is valid as a way forward in the debate, we need to see to what extent there are obstacles for real economy projects to take off in the region. And here we see some very interesting insights on what is really happening. We see that there are obstacles, but we see, and I want to underline that these obstacles are, you know, I would say severe when it comes to cross-border investment. And this is something that we need to take on board for the conversation that we'll be having today. Next slide, please. Final point, I would say, if the region needs growth drivers at the sectoral level, then we should look at how export orientation might facilitate and expedite this process. These are important trends. We see that the region is exporting more, but we see that the bulk of these exports are to EU, and a very limited progress has been done intra-regional trade, you know, through the years. The same picture arises in the next slide. Next slide, please. Same picture. During the financial crisis, we have seen some improvement of intra-regional trade, some improvement of trade, you know, beyond the EU to the rest of the world, but this has been very limited. So let me summarize. We need to go beyond aggregate trends and look at qualities, but also sectoral trends and processes. And we need to do that from the perspective of investment. You can stop my presentation. And now I will introduce our four fantastic speakers. The first speaker is Will Barrett. And Will will give us the broad picture. I mean, what are the growth drivers in the region? To what extent we have diverging growth trajectories in the Western Balkans, an area that he's very familiar with. And he will take us to the next level of my presentation, in a way. Will, you can start your presentation, please.
Okay, I hope you can hear me and everything's looking good. Yeah, okay, so this paper is an overview of the growth models in the region and the EU's policies towards regional cooperation and towards infrastructure investment in the region. Generally, over the last decade, the growth in the Western Balkans has recovered since the economic crisis of the early 2010s. And when we look at the growth path, we find that essentially Western Balkan economies are very integrated into the EU with through trade integration, migration, and inward FDI. So they're growth, the cycle of their growth, pattern of their growth follows very closely to the EU27. In fact, it's sort of determined very much by EU27 growth. But it's a little bit higher. It's about 1.5 percentage points above the EU growth, implying a gradual catch up. So that's sort of good news. However, the more prosperous countries are catching up faster, as do countries more advanced on their EU integration path. And I'll just show this through a few diagrams. Firstly, this is the real GDP growth rate over the period from 2012 to 2023. It's based on Eurostat data. You can see the actual growth there with the dip in the COVID period and the bounce back in 2021. And you can see the dotted lines are the trend growth rates, and the red line, which is the Western Balkans, is slightly above the EU27 trend. But when you compare the percentage, the extent of catch up by looking at the proportion of the relative GDP of the individual countries compared to the EU27, you can see this connection between the extent of catch up and the level of relative development. So the blue lines, the blue pillars represent the percentage change. So you can see that, for example, Croatia, which is not now in the Western Balkans, but used to be, and is a good comparator because it's a recently it's recently joined the EU, well, 10 years ago now, so not so recently, but over this period that we're looking at, this can give you an impression of the possible effect of joining the EU, relatively rapid catch-up by 10 percentage points compared to Albania, which has had very little catch-up and is hasn't moved very much. And then the red dots show the relative position relative to the EU in terms of GDP. And if you plot those two dimensions against each other, you see there's a very close relationship. The higher is GDP relative to the EU of a country, the faster they are catching up. So Croatia, for example, which joined the EU in 2013, over the subsequent 10 years, caught up quite substantially to the EU GDP, whereas Albania, starting positions in 2014 on the horizontal axis, was 30% of EU GDP, hasn't caught up very much at all. So this means that within the this country group, there is a divergence, even though overall and individually they're catching up with the EU, they're catching up at different rates and they're diverging from each other. And so this implies that for the, especially for the poorer countries of the region, it's important that they get a boost to growth through any means possible, essentially. And the various means which can be that can be achieved are one of them is through infrastructure investment, and that is what I shall look at now. So the EU strategy for growth in the Western Balkans has changed over time from an emphasis on institutional reform to a new emphasis on infrastructure investment. And this is in part due to perceived competition from new actors such as China and its Belt and Road Initiative and its increasing investments in the region. So it's not entirely altruistic, but it's part of the geopolitical, broader geopolitical competition between global economic and political blocks. But nevertheless, this change in policy orientation is favourable for, well, could potentially be favourable for Western Balkans if that infrastructure investment can be transformed into real economic growth. So this change in approach in terms of EU policy towards the region, EU approach to its engagement in the region, can be traced through the development of the different stages of what is known as the Berlin Process, which was a policy initiative by some of the main economies in the EU to try to promote European integration of the Western Balkans. And so one of the key features of the Berlin Process was the idea of regional cooperation, and that regional integration would provide a boost to economic growth alongside infrastructure investment, so and investment in general. So the multi-annual action plan for the regional economic area, the MAP-RIA, was introduced in 2017, which was the first sort of step on this journey. Is followed by a common idea for a proposal for a common regional market in 2020, alongside an economic and investment plan to stimulate infrastructure investment also in 2020. And then most recently, the so-called New Growth Plan, which was introduced in 2023. So these policies, these EU-inspired policies, had various dimensions, which were designed to improve the economic development of the region. So the MAP-RIA, the regional economic area, was focused on digital integration, mobility of skilled labour, trade integration to promote trade within the region through the CEFTA free trade agreement and its additional protocols on trade facilitation and trade in services, which have recently come into force. And then, importantly, from our point of view, the investment element through the regional investment reform agenda and the regional investment promotion program. And this was a response to the policies which had been introduced after the recession following the Eurozone crisis in the region, where individual countries started to develop their own individual industrial policies on a competitive rather than a regionally cooperative basis. So North Macedonia and Serbia in particular introduced FDI attraction policies, which were based upon quite strong subsidies, quite high subsidies for foreign investors, significant tax breaks, and establishing special economic zones with many benefits for foreign investment, all designed to attract FDI. And this led to allegations of a race to the bottom, a competitive reduction of tax breaks and the corporate taxes, and the competitive introduction of subsidies. And here you can see the pattern of what happened, that various industrial zones and so-called free zones, and having different names, were introduced in all the countries, but some of them were active and some of them were not active. And it's in particular in Macedonia, now North Macedonia and Serbia, that the special economic zones really took off. In North Macedonia, there are 8 active special economic zones, and in Serbia, there are 14 active special economic zones. And these are oriented to attracting foreign investment based on, as I said, low corporate profit tax rates and investment and employment subsidies. So this has been very effective in, for example, Serbia. Here you can see the ratio of foreign investment to GDP over the last decade or so, from 2012 to 2019. You can see for Serbia there, the very strong increase in the inflow of foreign investment into manufacturing sector, into motor car components in particular, and in other industrial sectors. To some extent in North Macedonia, but to a lesser extent, there's been an increase in FDI, but elsewhere FDI has been falling. So if you look at the right-hand set of columns there, you can see for the Western Balkans, the actual inflow of foreign direct investment has been more or less level. So the net effect of these new industrial policies, these FDI attraction policies in Serbia, Macedonia, North Macedonia, has been essentially to redirect the overall inflow away from other countries and into those two countries, and some slight extent Bosnia. So you could say that there's a real problem here, because countries are competing against each other for foreign investment rather than adopting a regional approach to increase foreign investment overall. And what this has meant is that the growth path of those countries which have been successful in attracting foreign direct investment into the manufacturing sectors have adopted a manufacturing-led growth path, leaving the other countries, Albania, Kosovo, and Montenegro, to follow a more services industry-led growth path. And you can see this here through the share of trade in GDP and goods trade and services trade. And the blue lines are the what are called Group A here, Bosnia, North Macedonia, and Serbia, the countries which have attracted a lot of foreign investment. They have increased their manufacturing exports substantially, and much less so focus on services exports, whereas the opposite has happened for the three countries, Albania, Kosovo, Montenegro, which have been less successful in attracting foreign investment. So they've been exporting services more than manufacturing, whereas the first group of countries have been exporting manufacturing goods rather than services.
Will, sorry to interrupt, if we can wrap it up in the next 60 seconds, if possible, because
okay. I'll go straight through to the Economic and Investment Plan, which is complementing the effort to promote regional economic integration. And this is a 9 billion euro grants program, which comes out of the EPA 3 funding for 2021 to 27. It's about 64% or 2/3 of the planned allocation over that period, supplemented by loans from the EIB and the EBRD, structured around various flagship projects, including sustainable transport and clean energy. And the aim is to boost economic growth in the region by investing in infrastructure. And about 50% of that investment is going into railways and roads as the largest subsectors. And within that, mainly into roads. And so in terms of coherence, the effort to promote clean energy and environmental and climate is rather contradicted by the boost to road infrastructure, which is likely to increase the number of car traffic. And this has been, which is obviously polluting and not necessarily in line with the green transition. Finally, the most recent new growth plan has focused on an additional $6 billion partly into the WBIF, that's the Western Balkans Investment Framework, so $3 billion into additional funding for infrastructure, and a further $3 billion to governments based on reform performance, so that they will only get that money if they actually introduce economic reforms. It's also designed to integrate the countries into the EU single market gradually, and to boost regional integration through the common regional market.
Will, just 20 seconds, please.
Okay, that goes to the conclusion then. With these various policies, the Commission's made a significant policy shift in its support for the Western Balkans away from institutional form to more infrastructure investment. And you can see there are two distinct growth models in the region, one based on a service economy, the other based on manufacturing. So the success of these infrastructure projects through these different EU approaches will have to be nuanced and adjusted to the pattern of growth in the different countries. And it's unlikely that a one-size-fits-all approach to economic growth will succeed if applied to the region without taking the different growth paths into account. Okay. Thank you.
Anthony, you're muted.
Thank you very much. We'll come back to this idea of having, you know, different growth trajectories in the Western Balkans and what that implies. Talking about the EU investment plan and growth prospects, we are very lucky to have two of the catalyzers of this process in the panel today. And I suggest that we can start with Sue Barrett, and she will give us the EBRD perspective on how things work in real life. Sue, the floor is yours. And please let's try to stick to the time limit. Thank you. Sure.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Anthony, and good afternoon, everyone. Yes, I'm Sue Barrett. I'm a Director of Infrastructure at the EBRD. Could I have the next slide, please? So the starting point here is that Southeastern Europe is a very important region for the EBRD, and unlocking its growth potential has been one of the key objectives of the EBRD since its inception in the early 90s. So just to give you a sense through a few figures what this actually means in practice, you can see that of the $200 billion that the EBRD has invested across the entire region to date, in the Southeastern Europe region, $50 billion has been invested by the EBRD, but that would also have come alongside mobilised financing from other financiers and donors. So a lot more money will have been mobilised alongside the EBRD investment. And that financing that we've put into the Southeastern Europe region accounts for about a quarter of our overall lending. So it's quite substantial. 15% was in the EU member states in Southeastern Europe, and around 10% in the Western Balkans, where we arguably have a greater role to play, certainly these days, in helping it to really catch up and grow the economy. And of this investment, around a third in Southeastern Europe has been in the infrastructure sectors that we are discussing today, so transport, energy, and digital infrastructure, with transport receiving the largest share of that investment. Can I have the next slide, please? When we look at the infrastructure investment that the bank has done by sector and by country, what we see is a fairly even distribution in the energy sector as between the EU member states and the Western Balkans. To a large extent, certainly in the EU member states, this has been driven by investment in renewable energy. Although in the Western Balkans, we do see quite a lot of investment in renewable energy, we also see investment which is sovereign based, unlike the renewables, which tends to be financed by the private sector. And this is in the transmission and distribution networks, which are in need of upgrading in that region. Looking at the digital infrastructure, certainly from EBRD's perspective, it has lagged behind in the Western Balkans. We've put three times as much into digital infrastructure in the EU countries. So there's more to do there in the Western Balkans in order to increase competitiveness and efficiency, because digitalization really certainly cuts across all of the infrastructure sectors and many others as well. When you look at the transport sector financing that we've done, I think this is most marked in a way. It's higher, and it's substantially higher in the Western Balkans than it is in the EU member states of Southeastern Europe. And in fact, since those countries acceded to the European Union, we've actually done very little on the transport side in terms of investment. And this has largely been because of our low additionality. So in other words, there are others that can make those investments, and the fact that the European Union has provided a lot of grant funding to develop those transport networks, particularly roads, as Will mentioned, but also railways. Really what we have been focusing on is on improving the connectivity of the transport networks in the Western Balkans. Now, Will actually mentioned this as well. He mentioned the Western Balkans investment framework, and that has actually been a big driver of the investment that we have made in the transport sector in the Western Balkans. And I'll talk a bit more about this. It certainly has been an initiative which has really provided a big incentive and boosted investment in the transport sector. If I could have the next slide, please. So just a bit more on this Western Balkans investment framework. In 2009, EBRD was one of the architects of the framework, together with the European Commission, with the European Investment Bank, and also a number of bilateral donors. And what it does is it pools resources, financial resources, together for investment purposes, grant resources, which can be blended with loan financing. And in total, over the years, I think around 3.9 billion of financing has been raised in terms of grant funding through the Western Balkans framework, which has been blended with around 5.6 billion in development loans. And this whole framework was set up in response to the Eurozone crisis, but also to support closer integration with the European Union. And what we have seen actually is and you can see from the graph here, is that the transport sector has been by far the biggest recipient of the funding made available through this framework, although other sectors, environmental, social and digital, have also benefited to some extent. Between 2009 and 2023, 2.6 billion euros of WBAF grant funding has been mobilized, and that has financed over 50 projects which are on the core network, which is the trans-European extension, EU trans-European network extension. And EBRD was involved in around half of these projects, many of them actually also co-financed with the European Investment Bank and others. One thing I think is also important to mention, which has been very important in terms of what's been made available through the Western Balkan Investment Framework, is the amount of technical assistance that has been made available. In total, it's not far short of half a billion euros. In the transport sector, those investments have benefited from about 200 million euros in technical assistance, which has been used for many purposes, for preparing feasibility studies, for preparing preliminary and detailed designs, to help with the assessment of the environmental and social impacts, to provide project implementation support, and also in some cases to promote sector reform and capacity building. So, you know, whilst the level of investment that has been generated through this framework is impressive, there is still a lot more to be done, as I'll explain in a moment. But the amount of technical assistance that has been required also points to some of the challenges challenges that are faced by this region in terms of investing and catching up with the EU. Next slide, please. And you know, the remaining infrastructure gap is very large. The IMF recently estimated that infrastructure development in the Western Balkans is 50% lower than the EU average. So there is a lot that needs to be done in order to catch up. There are many challenges. Many of them are also very well known. The slow pace of reform, the limited fiscal space, and the slow pace of reform, so the weak governance, the imperfect regulatory frameworks, the low tariffs, these actually all compound the limited fiscal space because it also then makes it more challenging to bring in private sector capital to help speed up the development. Also, there is weak institutional capacity generally, so it takes time to implement. There's a lot of delays in terms of implementation of projects. So a lot of issues around institutional capacity. And of course, this all leads to low connectivity within the Western Balkans and also with the rest of Europe and beyond. And there's also now an added pressure, which is the need to boost energy transition and also to increase digitalization, because all of these factors will help to develop the private sector, to grow the economy in a sustainable way, and also facilitate integration with the EU. Next slide, please.
1 minute left.
Sure, very quickly. I don't need to say much on this slide because Will has already mentioned it, which is the next stage in the development for the Western Balkans is the new growth plan, which will provide a further 6 billion in loans and grant funding. And what is important for us as an institution is that 3 billion of this will be made through the Western Balkans Investment Framework. Next slide, please. So just to wrap up, what we always do and will continue to do to support growth across the southeastern region is to make sure that the scarce resources that are available for investment are being used efficiently. We will certainly be helping to make sure that projects are well prepared so that they attract finance, not just from us, but from others. Continue to do that blending of financing, which is very important, particularly important when we're talking about the new technologies, because these tend to be more expensive, and so they need the blended financing. And building capacity, we do a lot of work around building capacity of our clients and governments in the region, and of course, promoting innovation to enhance climate resilience and inclusion across the sector. I will leave it there, and thank you very much for listening.
Thank you very much, Sue, and we'll come back to some of the issues you raised already. Now, let's turn to the other major investment in the region, which is the EIB. Matteo is with us. He is in charge of the EIB portfolio in the region. So, Matteo, the floor is yours, but let's keep the time limit, please.
Thank you very much, and thank you for uploading the presentation. It's a pleasure to be with you and to speak after Sue. With EBRD, we've financed a lot of projects so far. I'm speaking on behalf of the EIB. The European Investment Bank is the bank of the European Union, is owned by the European Union member states. It primarily invests for infrastructure and private sector within the European Union, but also historically has always been very attentive to support the areas that are where European Union is going to enlarge. And that is the reason why we have a particular area of attention, particular scope and focus on the Western Balkans since now more than 40 years. I will focus on three points. Number one, the challenges that as a practitioner we identified in the region of the Western Balkans. Number two, the one and only opportunity ahead. And number three, just a very bit of information about what the EIB does indeed in the Western Balkans. Let me start with the challenges. Now, again, from a practitioner point of view that is willing to indeed unlock the economic prospects and potential of this region, there are a number of challenges, but I would like to focus on four of them. Number one, slow pace of reforms. Reforms, particularly around the rule of law, have taken longer than expected in this region. Speaking of examples where, appointing judges in Supreme Courts have taken years, ensuring secondary legislation to avoid political interferences in the public administration has not been implemented and adopted yet. Or if you think about trade facilitation measures and the way the border crossing points are still very slow and very non-efficient due to lack of reforms and uniformity in the way that the freight can be going through, is one of the examples that again is very important from an economic point of view. Obviously, over and beyond the fact that human rights, democracy, and so on and so forth need to be, let's say, reformed. I mean, these areas need to be reformed in line with the European accession pattern. Number two, socioeconomic infrastructure, socioeconomic challenges. We can talk about the economic informality of this region, again, that is looked by foreign investors as an issue, but most importantly here, the number of the brain drain are appalling. In this region, I'm coming from a country where, the negative demographic trend are an issue. But here it's not only about negative demographic trend. These are about people that young, best human assets are leaving this region on a recurrent basis, basically depriving this region from their best assets going ahead. Number three, technical expertise, if you like, is very connected with the one that I just said. We're experiencing a lack of capacity at level, that goes, including the private sector, but particularly in the public sector. That is particularly concerning for example, a number of investors that want to engage also on a concession basis with this type of counterparts. Especially in terms of preparatory work and then implementation capacity of projects. Last but not least, it's the energy situation, and this region, particularly carbon intensive, has really not done yet a lot about transitioning away from fossil fuels towards the decarbonized economies. And not even in terms of reforms, thinking of the unbundling in the energy sector in Serbia that still is lagging behind. So these are a few of the main challenges that are, let's say, depriving this region from possible additional potential for moving ahead in attracting additional investment and mobilizing additional private capital. So what is the opportunity ahead? It's one and only, and it's this new growth plan. Much has been said, and I'm not going to be delving into it, but I just want to make sure that there's no plan B. If we believe that this region is going to be part of the European Union, this is the way to go. For the first time, European Union said it clearly. Payments, financial assistance against reform. Financial assistance not only from the European taxpayers, but also from the European Investment Bank and EBRD through the WBIF. In case there are steps ahead, reforms that need to be made. And I just want to make loud and clear that, also in terms of common and regional market, these are reforms that are needed. I mean, now they're closing. I mean, here in Kotor, where I met with the leaders, here there is a positive momentum about the reform agenda and the way that these reforms will be agreed upon in the coming days. But also in terms of common regional market, this is a key to facilitate the entry into the European single market. Otherwise, once these countries will enter, their economies will be wiped out by the let's say the standards of the EU single market. Let me give you an example. We financed Fiat in the past, and then Stellantis, for them to enlarge their manufacturing capacity in Serbia, in Kragujevac in particular. And the first thing they said to us and also to the Serbian government when they started their financing, now they've just upgraded it, their projects, the investments they just upgraded, is like, yes, fine about having a manufacturing plant there, but how will we be able to ship our Fiat Panda through the region to the port of Bari and then to the main market, which is Italy. So our infrastructures, our border crossing points, are, let's say, customs, available enough for us to have a regional, market where we can invest successfully for us to export globally and then to integrate in global supply chain. So this is why common regional market is essential to enter the European single market for this region.
Matteo, if you would mind wrapping up in 1 minute, please. Thank you.
Can I close with the next slide? Just to say that the European Investment Bank is present in all sectors, particularly infrastructure and financing in private sector. We have a portfolio that is quite diversified. Our North Star, however, is the climate action. That is the reason why in 2023 we're happy to have scored very highly in terms of climate action and environmental sustainability. We financed over the last 3 years more than 3 billion euro together with the EIB, with EBRD and Western Balkan Investment Framework. And we're looking ahead, particularly on, 4 sectors, like 1, connectivity, 2, the twin or green transition, digital transition, and SME sector in terms of, private sector development. And if you go to the last slide, you will see that we are also locally present on the ground, and we have offices in Belgrade, Sarajevo, Tirana, Skopje, and soon in Podgorica and Pristina. And with this, I thank you very much for your attention.
Many thanks, Matteo. These are very rich presentations and experience, and I feel a bit, difficult to interrupt, but it's important to leave some time for questions. Now we come to the final speaker, Professor Slavo Radojevic. I know that it's very challenging for evolutionary scholar to make a presentation in 8 minutes, but Slavo, please try to keep to the time.
No, so absolutely fine.
Excellent. Thank you.
Because I see I cannot go through the whole presentation. So because I knew that most of the discussion will be on current issues, I intentionally decided to take a long-term perspective because I'm also involved in very much current and advisory activities. But I think that increases further need to look at the issue from the distance. First of all speakers and we kind of focused on the Western Balkans, ignoring the whole region, and even within the Western Balkans, focusing on individual countries. My argument would be basically that we really have to change our discourse, and in some sense, decolonizing not only academic research but the policy perspective on that. So in that context, I will not go through the what has happened because I see now that already speakers have explored it. This is a part of my presentation, is a part of a much longer paper, which is based on a lots of statistics, which looks at the region in a long-term perspective. And my main argument would be that these factors of endogenous growth in Southeastern Europe, when we look at them, and I here highlight several of these factors, population, income distribution, demand, science, innovation, enterprise, financial sector, government, and none of these factors by itself is a powerful driver of growth that could set a change in other factors in motion. So that is the argument. And I'd be happy to send this draft paper to anybody who is interested and give me comments because there is evidence for and a bit of evidence for each of these factors. This is quite important because when we look at the peripheral regions in the economic history, then we see that what happens in the region is never entirely determined only by the region. It is always a result of the interaction of the region, which is periphery, or we'll call it super periphery, with the core, with the interactions. And we've seen actually today in today's presentation that it is partly the truth. The whole infrastructure shift wouldn't have happened without Chinese, without now Europe reacting to that. So when we look at the individual factors, let me just go very, very briefly. We see that the demand is not a strong feature. We see depopulation, we see low activity levels, we see income inequalities, which are relatively reasonable, so that's not so much. Then we see the high unemployment of highly skilled in some countries, other facing skill constraints. Pockets of sophisticated demand, there is emerging middle class, which is a hope for the future. But overall, this is not the kind of strong factor. Then we see deindustrialization on one hand and servicification. That trend has slowed down, which is positive. Then we see kind of Romania and Bulgaria gradually being integrated into the EU industrial networks. Then we see other parts of the region, North Macedonia, Albania, being involved in a more labor-intensive activities. And this raises the question, of course, whether these services may become the driver of this growth. We see in ICT in Romania, Serbia, and Bulgaria, there is a critical mass, and there is a hope for the future there. When you look at the more at the enterprise side, at the innovation side, then we see that the economies are dominated by SMEs, which operate isolated. They're not linked to large firms. Large firms are not very R&D active. They are kind of local monopolists. And we see kind of, I would call it dual innovation system, where we have R&D groups are increasingly integrated into EU networks, but that is completely, increasingly delinked what is happening on the enterprise side. Then we see financial sector doesn't seem to be factor of advantage, despite the fact that, you know, kind of is also foreign led. We see orientation towards real estate and consumer durables from the past that continues today. We see this large infrastructure project. We had two excellent presentations on that. But more versatile sources of finance are required. And that is all compounded with a weak rule of law and inadequate business strategy. And we see these EU funds are the only macroeconomically relevant inflow today in the region. When you look at the government, then government is in none of the countries effective at the level of developed economies, which you would say, okay, good government will drive the growth. We see the paths and trajectories, which are very much country specific. There is a slow secular trend of improvement. So we must recognize that. And then, so these are kind of endogenous factors. None of them is kind of like able to push the others, to complement the others. And that is basically the whole challenge of semi-development. Then the hope is what happens on the FDI side, on value chain integration. These are small economies for whom the export is to be or not to be. And then we have this striking contrast between Central European manufacturing cluster and Southeast Europe being out of it, or it's gradually getting into that. They're becoming maybe assembly type of economies in the future. And then we see kind of integration again onto one Central European and kind of nominally high-tech sector and including sectors in some of the countries. You know, kind of. The problem there is obviously Germany as one of the engine is losing steam, which is kind of having devastating effect on the region. The issue is whether this reshoring, friendshoring, whether that is a potential gain. On the positive side, we see this increasing role of ICT services in export. So in overall, when you look at it, you don't see much also on the external side happening. So in conclusion, my argument is that endogenous factors are not individually strong to set in motion growth chains, or they're not mutually complementing each other. And so the catch up, if you go, we are looking at the future, in my view, will happen only when you have a kind of complementarity with what happens domestically and what happens on the external side. And this kind of the EU is now in a situation where it's kind of changing, or hopefully it's kind of discourse on the region, especially because EU is now aiming to develop its own industrial policy. And then I think it should take more whole Southeastern Europe view on that, rather than going on this bilateral in kind of a very much colonizing type of policies. And how actors from core economies behave in relation to periphery is extremely important. The local elites, they are also important in that, because they are those which can handle this relationship between being open and then some kind of degree of autonomy and national industrial policy. So the issue is, who controls this modernization process, how these countries combine openness with that kind of independence. And unfortunately, current political and business elites are probably still short-term, rent-seeking oriented, and infrastructures go well in relation to that, but will it reach its limits? And this is something which I think is quite relevant for our possible discussion later on. So my argument is that the integration can drive growth for some time, but unless we see the combination between endogenous and external factors, we will not see kind of getting out of this kind of peripheral status. So this is the general lesson, and I would be happy then to you know, bring that down to more specific level. What does it mean in terms of policy? So I think I'm perfectly within the time, and I thank you very much.
Thank you, Slavo. That has been fantastic, and we'll come back to the proposals that you're making. Let's start with the first round of discussion. I have the privilege to initiate that. I would like to start with Sue, and my questions are going to be very concrete, and I would very much appreciate, say, a one-minute response for all of them. My question to Sue is really about the link between transportation and logistics. How does it work? Is it possible to improve? What is the EBRD experience on this link? Sue, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I mean, yes, I think the logistics is extremely important. I mean, it's all very well putting in these large corridors, but actually how you get from those corridors, the last mile and the logistics and the intermodal as well, I think is extremely important. We do see a number of investments in this area, not so many actually in the Western Balkans and in Southeastern Europe, it's basically private sector driven, and it's a very important element of the transport network. So it's very much needed in terms of improving trade and improving the prosperity of the region. So it's something that we're very much focused on in terms of our investment objectives, and that can be in fleets or it can be in warehousing or whatever. But it's intermodal and logistics is certainly key for development of the transport sector and overall connectivity.
Thank you, Sue. Let me turn to Matteo. Matteo, the case of Chinese investment in the region was raised twice so far in the debate we are having. So my question to you from a very practical point of view is, what is really happening on the ground? Are you competing with Chinese investors? Do they have the same quality standards like the investments that you are funding? Give us your perspective on this issue. Thank you.
Thank you. Let me say, first of all, we are the guardian of the European Union mantra as regards, let's say, openness and transparency. Openness means openness to all economic players across the globe, which is including, obviously, Chinese players. That is the reason why we have seen that a number of infrastructures that even European funds have been supporting have been constructed, for example, by Chinese construction companies. Or, and in that respect, so long as, let's say, procurement has been respected, so long as technical standards are at the very least as the same height of the European standards, and the tendering procedure is let's say acceptable enough, we have seen that I can give you the example of the Pelješac bridge that has been financed to connect Croatia, has been financed according to the best standards and has been financed by European Union financing. So that is to say openness also for Chinese players. However, we look also at two things. Number one, we see that the number of bidders are abnormally low. Now, does that mean that there is an element of state subsidy that is not being captured by the current legislation that governs our, let's say, procurements? I'm putting it as a question. Number two, we're seeing that a number of support from a financial perspective from Chinese players to this region is not transparent, as it is transparent the financing from European Union or European Investment Bank, EBRD, and so on and so forth. So at least these two elements are reason for concern. And I think the European Union in Brussels, there is a high awareness of this matter.
Many thanks, Matteo, and thanks very much for the openness and detailed response that you're giving. Let me turn to Will. Will, my question is about risk profile of countries. I mean, if, say, a rating agency or a major investment will approach you and say, give us your assessment of the risk profile of individual countries in the Western Balkans, would you agree that they're all the same? Will you distinguish between different cases? What would be your response on this? Will, the floor is yours.
Will, you're muted.
Well, I'll say that the risk profile has probably diminished over time compared to what it was 20 years ago or even 10 years ago. I mean, there's the problem of the Serbia-Kosovo normalization, and we've recently seen some sort of conflict in Kosovo with Serbian paramilitary organizations making an incursion. So things are not looking completely bright there at all. I don't think it's getting at the moment worryingly serious in any way. I mean, Bosnia, the Republic of Srpska keeps threatening to break away, and there's tensions there. So, yeah, I mean, there's all sorts of still problems for geopolitical risk and so on. And this might affect the private investors' decision to invest in the region. And as you've seen, the actual ratio of foreign investment to GDP has been rather flat over the last few years. I mean, it hasn't, as the region as a whole, I'm talking about Western Balkans, not Southeast Europe. It hasn't been going up, but on the other hand, it hasn't been going down either. So, I think the region is stable in that sense, although it's not necessarily the most welcoming region in and of itself. And that's why, Serbia and North Macedonia have had to introduce very strong investment incentives to attract foreign investment. But nevertheless, they have succeeded in doing that. So I think with the right policies, foreign investment can be attracted to the region. Foreign investment into manufacturing, even services sector, can be export boosting. I mean, Slavo made the point that exports are key driver, and probably foreign investment attraction is important in that, alongside also infrastructure investment. But I think when it comes to infrastructure investment, the key point there is the reforms that are taking place, or that should take place, as has been mentioned, and the returns to infrastructure investment. I think economic research shows that the returns to infrastructure investment can be high, but only where there's an appropriate institutional environment. And if you have high levels of state capture, clientelism, corruption, high level corruption, and so on, then the returns to public infrastructure investment are likely to be much lower, because the quality of that infrastructure will be low because of giving contracts to chums rather than the best providers. And the part of the infrastructure investment will be siphoned off to politically connected companies and individuals. So there's I think that reform aspect is probably at least as important as the geopolitical risk aspect.
Thank you, Will. And my very last question goes to Salvo.
To me, you mean? Yeah, okay.
Yes, Salvo, yes.
Yeah, I think we should first broaden the notion of infrastructure. Yeah, of course, we are now in the kind of discovering...
Slavo, can I ask you a question?
Oh, yes. Oh, sorry. I thought you wanted me.
No. Okay. Let's assume that we have in the audience a senior official from Brussels and a senior official from, one of the countries in Western Balkans. And they come to you and they ask a very concrete question. What do you think we are doing wrong on promoting, say, the knowledge economy, and what we should do? How you would respond?
Well, first of all, I wouldn't start with a kind of this notion of knowledge economy, so to say. This is about industrial
upgrading. 2 minutes.
Yeah,
so in 2 minutes.
I think my answer will be actually along the different lines. I think it's the I would try to argue that from the EU perspective, EU should think about the overall Southeastern Europe. Policy is too much oriented towards individual countries, which has several problems. No critical mass in any of these countries. No complementarity of skills. No differentiation in cost. These are all opportunities which can be exploiting only at the regional level. And EU is now in a kind of new policy world, new policy philosophy, where it has to understand that it has to develop macro-regional strategy. And it is not only towards Southeastern Europe, but towards the all the others. But Southeastern Europe is desperate for macro-regional industrial strategy. And this is the best way then to think about the knowledge economy, about the technology upgrading, where you think about the broader notion of infrastructure. It's not only physical infrastructure, which is quite significant, important, don't misunderstand me. But what about the skills? What about the whole issue of certification of all the sector-specific infrastructure activities? We may build a road, but somebody has to drive something on these roads which is of value. And so therefore, let's not just go now on one bandwagon and forget that we are not resolving the other constraints which are equally important. Yeah, so that's the 1 minute answer.
Excellent. My take from the fascinating debate we're having so far is that cross-border investment and integration is really extremely important in the region. And with that, I pass the floor to Vasilis.
Okay, thank you very much, Anthony. I obviously will bring in some of the questions from the audience. If you are in the audience and want to ask more questions, please use the Q&A button to ask your question. And thanks to the people who have done. I mean, obviously, we need to continue the discussion, so I have also some questions of my own. Let me then start with my take the prerogative and ask the question of my own. Prompted by what Slavo said, that the EU should stop seeing countries as countries and try to think about sort of macro-regional strategies and so forth, I was about to ask the opposite question. Is it time to concede that there's no such thing as the Western Balkan region? Because, of course, everybody who graduates and gets into the European Union removes themselves from the region. And either think about individual countries or think about the Southeast Europe region, or as Slavo said, macro regions. We used to have macro regions, the Adriatic macro region, and so forth. And let's remind ourselves that the successful examples of the Baltic states and in some points in time of the the CE4, they haven't been through institutional engineering. The regional cooperation that happened in Central Eastern Europe or in the Baltics was not through institutional engineering from Brussels. It was more a bit more indigenous, spontaneous. So perhaps also the development bankers in the panel could tell us whether, looking as a Western Balkan perspective instead of a national versus a broader regional perspective is conducive or not conducive to supporting development. Can I pass the floor to Sue, for example, if she wants to say something about
that? Yes, thank you. So you were basically saying, do we think we should look at each country individually rather than looking at as the Western Balkans? I think yes, because I think I forget whose slides we were looking at, showing that those different countries are moving at different paces, so they need different things. So I think you do need to look at the countries individually and what are their individual needs. I mean, if you look at Serbia, for example, I would say that is further advanced than say Albania or Bosnia. It's not to say that you can't do some of the same types of investments in those different countries. So if we look at how do we bring the private sector into those countries in the infrastructure space? For example, the Albanian airport was actually concessioned before any of the others in the Western Balkan region. But, there are differences in the speed of development. There's differences in the level of capacity. And so I think when we're looking at the Western Balkans, we don't say, oh, for the Western Balkans, we expect to do X, Y, and Z. We look at each individual country and see what does it need in order to develop the economy, develop the capacity, and really grow the economy. So I think it should be country by country rather than thinking of the Western Balkans as being homogeneous.
Thanks. So would somebody, Matteo, would you like to speak to the point? Please.
Yes. The answer is yes. And I think is built upon the fact that there are at least two factors that need to be taken into consideration. Number one is that this region needs to enter the European Union country by country, not by region. And this has been the enlargement policy so far within the European Union. It's not that Slovenia and Croatia enter together rather or else. The moment the country, each and every country, meets the requirement, economic and political requirement to enter the European Union, then the country goes. And it is very likely that this will be the case also in this region. So it will be country by country. Second, for the first time, this new growth plan introduces a logic of competitive nature. If a country performs better than another one within the same region, it will get more funding. So it's again a country by country reasoning. That said, I want to repeat the fact that this region, from a, let's say, global player, global chain, and so on and so forth, is seen as a region. So in terms of infrastructure capacity, in terms of reforms, in terms of, fluidity of people, freight, and services, I mean, we need to see for a market player something that is seen not only for Montenegro, but for the entirety of the region, for this player to invest in this region. Thank you.
Thank you, Matteo. I'll pass the floor to Will and Slavo, perhaps, but let me bring in a question from the audience, and then you can, of course, speak to different points. So one of the questions, I think, is addressed to Slavo is, how can they, Slavo, you mentioned that there's the endogenous drivers are not sufficient, and then the EU stimulus is what is going on. And the question, I think, is how can the EU driver mobilize the endogenous drivers, if there's a particular sort of set of recommendations, I guess, I would do that. And then I would ask also Will to address another point asked by Marilena Petraku from the European Investment Bank. Which of the new growth plan areas would be more, the biggest impact on boosting economic growth and accelerate convergence? So the new growth plan, of course, we can assess it if you want in its entirety, but is it the digital transition? Is it human capital development? Is it the green aspect? What can stimulate growth the most? So Slavo, we start from you.
This is a very kind of relevant question. I think that the issue is, for me, that the EU doesn't look at the accession and this whole Southeastern Europe as a kind of, let's call it, development economics issue. That is basically in its own interest to facilitate growth in this region for its own interest. It looks at it as a kind of institutional conformance issue. You meet all the requirements, and I don't care where you are economically. I don't care what will effect it has on me. And that's, for me, completely kind of outdated view to look at the situation today. You have to look at it in terms of global political economy and how that can contribute to the overall EU. That's possible only if you look at the whole Southeastern Europe as a region. Therefore, it for me is inevitable that you think in terms of, within my EU industrial policy, how can I fit this region and facilitate the growth of the region to my own benefits. If you look at it only as an institutional issue, almost like issue for lawyers, I think there's nothing there to talk why we're complaining about growth, because that's not the primary objective.
Thank you, Slavo. Will, the new growth plan, what can work? And also, may I add also another question to you. Can it work at all, given the difficulties? I think this is a question from Sanya Papcevic from Hungary. Given what we know about the rise of right-wing politics, not only in the Balkans, more generally, and populism, can the new growth plan lead to the institutional reforms that it aspires to?
Okay. I think, the new growth plan is not really, it's not really new, and it's not particularly a growth plan. So it's more an extension of the economic investment plan in so far as it brings in some new money, 6 billion euros of new money to the region for infrastructure investment and as a reward for reforms. So, there's two questions about whether it can succeed. First is, does infrastructure investment promote growth? And as I've already said, the evidence seems to show that infrastructure investment does promote growth, but it doesn't promote growth where you've got the type of regimes, type of political economies, which we find in the Western Balkans, with the state capture and the corruption, the clientelism that will sort of be a countervailing factor. Secondly, Sorry, I forgot what I was going to say about the second part now. But I mean, growth has been achieved to some extent. As I showed in my slides, the region is growing slightly faster than the EU, but it's in the more backward countries, where Albania, Kosovo, where really the effort has to be made, I think. So Serbia has been fairly successful in attracting private investment, and it probably has resources to deal with infrastructure, whereas Albania and Kosovo don't really have the resources to do much in the way of infrastructure, so they need much more support. And I think when it comes to sectors, you mentioned, I mean, we haven't talked very much about human capital, which is one of the flagship proposals in the economic investment plan. We focused very much on transport and energy, but I think the human capital development, the skills and the education systems are hugely important in the modern world. The development of ICT skills, and computer literacy and digital skills are going to be increasingly important. And I think that's a sort of Cinderella sector. The danger being in these 9 billion economic investment plan and 6 billion new growth plan, that the majority of it will go into this sort of hard infrastructure rather than in the social infrastructure, in education, and to some extent health. But education needs a huge boost, and I think it's neglected, and that's a mistake, I think. And I think that will yield big returns in terms of growth if it would be pushed up the policy agenda.
Thank you, Will. I will allow the opportunity for Matteo and Sue to also say something on the new growth plan if you want, but I want to address you to other questions from the audience. I think the first one is quite important, by Jairai Chavan, I think, a student from Maastricht University. Anthony, how does the EBRD and the European Investment Bank determine the amount of money to invest in the Western Balkan countries, given the risk such as weak institutional capacities and limited private sector participation? What could be done? What could be some reasons to increase or decrease investments by stakeholders and businesses? So basically, how are these allocations decided? And then if I may, to give you also another question by Lambis Kodonis from the Western Balkan Working Group in the European Parliament, where he says that, of course, all the international development banks and the international financing institutions have contributed a lot to Southeast Europe development. However, there's a criticism that civil society, local communities are not involved enough. There's an example about, so for example, planning for building for hydroelectric power plants, that there's not enough consultation, consideration of environmental concerns, safeguards, and so forth. Is there a policy to deal with these matters in an improved way in the future? So how do you decide the allocations given problems of potential corruption capacity, but also how can we make sure that this is for the people and not for, you know, it delivers for the people, not just on the numbers? Thank you. Maybe Matteo first, or
thank you. First, how do we determine as a EIB funding capacity for the countries in this region in particular? We have no preset limits. We are demand driven. So we look at the investment opportunity in a, let's say, according to a logic and to a policy that is the one aligned with the priority set by the European Union. For example, the one set by the growth plan, the new growth plan now. And further to a due diligence that entails a number of aspects. Once there is a satisfaction, then we move ahead and we invest in the project and we monitor the implementation until the entirety of the life of an infrastructure, for example. And this is demonstrated by the fact that if you look at our numbers, you might be surprised by the fact that if you look again our numbers against GDP size or population size of the countries, you may see that the ratios are counterintuitive. So we may do quite something in small countries and not as much in big countries. But that's again based on the fact that we are demand driven. Second, how do we ensure that all the issues that are very pertinently mentioned, corruption, integrity, compliance, and let's say proper community engagement are taken care of? Well, these are, I think, and Sue may confirm, but together with EBRD, we're second to none in terms of due diligence and in terms of ensuring that all these aspects are fully factored into our due diligence and in the implementation phase of the investment. So I think there is always area for improvement, but we do locally engage. We do ensure that all the environmental and social, let's say, due diligence is according to the highest standards of the European Union, not of the country legislation. And we do our best to ensure that this goes throughout the life of the project. Thank you.
EBRD's position is actually quite similar to EIB's position, in the sense that we also don't have predetermined limits for these countries for investing in the Western Balkans. We are very much demand driven, as is the European Investment Bank. And so what we're looking at is on one hand country priorities, and on the other hand other priorities such as the European Union, which is, you know, European integration is also very important. So we make sure that the projects that we're being asked to finance are feasible and priorities for the country. And as Matteo says, we also do at a level of detailed level of due diligence on these projects to make sure that they align with our environmental and social policy, our requirements in terms of integrity and transparency. So it's really more about what is it that we're actually, what actually is the demand and the need, rather than how much do we want to put in a particular country. And one thing I would say is that we are by no means put off by weak institutional capacity or any of these other issues. What we try to do is to support and increase and build capacity. So, you know, with the projects that we're financing, it's not just about giving money to finance infrastructure, it's what about what's the impact we can have beyond the investment that we're making. And often that will be around trying to build capacity and address some of these institutional weaknesses. And when it comes to things like integrity and all those kinds of things, we'll be helping with governance, you know, basic governance, putting in place hiring policies, procurement policies, and so on and so forth. So weak capacity, you know, as Matteo was saying, it's kind of sometimes counterintuitive. We'll put more into a country which looks weaker than one that's actually stronger, because there's more for us to do beyond the investment itself. In terms of the environmental and social impacts, we do have very rigorous environmental and social assessments done on all of the projects that we do. We actually categorize each of our projects so we understand the level of environmental and social impacts, and really look very closely at how we can mitigate, avoid, or sort of address those impacts in the best possible way. We produce an environmental and social impact assessment, and for the sort of the highest category projects, we will disclose that publicly, and we do have public consultation meetings on these important projects. So we also try as far as we can to provide projects which are environmentally and socially sustainable and do address the needs of the local population that are impacted by them. And to answer that question about do we have a policy on this, yes, we do. We have an environmental social policy that actually just being updated. So every time we update, we try to improve. And that policy itself is also subject to public consultation. So we really do try our best to address these very important issues for local communities and others that are affected by the projects that we're financing.
Thank you, Sue. We have another couple of questions, but I'm afraid we're running out of time. Let me just mention, there was a question about Chinese investment, especially in the green energy field. I think Matteo said something about China, and definitely Sue and both of you said about sort of the environmental aspect and the attention to that. There's also a question about overcoming problems of brain drain. and so forth. I think we'll leave these questions open. Let me close the event by the last word would be Anthony's. So Anthony, just a warning for you. But just to say, to thank all the speakers for the participation, to say that our next event from the side of the Hellenic Observatory is an in-person event that is coming up on Thursday, 23rd of May, so in a week's time. At the London School of Economics at Wilson Theatre, 6 o'clock to 8 o'clock, we have a projection of a documentary and discussion, Searching for Andreas, Political Leadership in Times of Crisis. This is very Greek specific, but I think with wider perhaps interest. Let me allow the last minute of our meeting to pass back the floor to Anthony and a bit provocatively ask you for a one-minute reflection using the title of our event. Do you think that the new instruments and the efforts by the development banks, the new growth plan, will ever unlock the growth potential of the region? Or should we wait for 10 years after everybody joins the European Union and then the markets will do it for us?
No, I think what we understand from today's meeting is that there are many challenges and the policy process needs to be informed by these challenges, but also from practical experience. Because what we have seen is, you know, broad ideas of what needs to be done, the kind of long-term view, but also we have seen interesting, you know, suggestions and recommendations on how things work in practice. I think policymakers should incorporate these ideas and this feedback as much as possible. For our part, what we are going to do is, in the summary of what we discussed today, in the blog that we'll produce, we'll try to make, you know, good use of everything that was introduced in the presentations, because 8 minutes was really very short for this rich conversation. So stay tuned and you know, wait for the report of the seminar, which will really try to capture everything that was proposed to us through the 4 presentations. And many thanks to all the panelists for all the good work that they put together for this meeting. And to you, Vasilis, for, you know, having the challenge to keep us on track. Thank you.
Thank you.
And to you, Anthony, for putting the event together. Thanks to our audience. Check our website for the report after post-event. It's going to be a blog, and also the presentations, I think, will be available on our website. Thank you all to all speakers, and see you in the next one.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you.